Hello, I'm Elena Del Val, and this is the HispanicNPR.com podcast. My guest today is OBR Silverwood, who is author of Industrial Real Estate Investing and Management, a comprehensive guide to buying, leasing, and selling industrial buildings. We will discuss investing in industrial real estate. Obi was employed for 5 years by the National Cash Register Company, marketing commercial computer systems for accounting application, from which he gained accounting skills. In 1976, he began his commercial real estate brokerage career at the Newport Beach office of Grubb & Ellis. In 1981, he opened a brokerage in Irvine, California, specializing in industrial properties. According to his bio, he has personally transacted millions of square feet of industrial building sales, exchanges, and leases, representing clients and for his own portfolio, as well as investing in industrial real estate provided him a multi-million dollar net worth and adequate income to retire from brokerage in his mid-40s. He has been continuously licensed in good standing as a California Department of Real Estate broker since 1977. Obi, welcome.
Thank you for having me on, Elena.
Let's start with a brief conflict of interest statement, if you would.
Well, I don't really think there is any conflict of interest. I'm the author of the book. I hold the copyright on it, and I no longer represent clients in brokering properties. I only deal with my own properties, my own portfolio, so there's no conflict of interest.
What do we mean by industrial real estate? What exactly does that mean? What is an industrial building, or what is industrial real estate?
Well, it falls under the general categories commercial real estate, and commercial real estate has six property types. One type is retail, which would be like shopping centers, freestanding buildings like a McDonald's or something, where you sell directly to the public. The second category would be office, like high-rise or single-level office buildings. The third category is industrial. And in under industrial, you have the subcategories of manufacturing type building, warehouse type building, high tech type building, research and development buildings. And then the fourth category is residential income properties, rental houses, apartments. The fifth category is agriculture. And the sixth is miscellaneous. And that would cover churches, country clubs, golf courses, hospitals, airports, government facilities, things like that. With regard to my area that I prefer, which is small industrial buildings, excuse me, and by small, I mean, 5 to 10,000 square feet in size, because industrial buildings, they go up to a million square feet in size, but my preference is 5 to 10, and I'll explain why later. But those buildings, their construction is one of two types, either metal, which is called a Butler-style construction, or concrete tilt, where they pour a slab and tilt the walls up. They're usually 10 to 20% office in the front of the building, which is like three, four private offices, a receptionist area, maybe a wet bar, office restroom, and a shop restroom. And a couple of truck doors along the side of the building, a asphalt yard area, and that pretty well defines what you have when it comes to industrial. And that's pretty standardized throughout the nation, too.
On the small industrial side, so 5 to 10,000 square feet, what are the types of tenants that you might have? Because the whole goal here is to rent out, buy the building and rent it out. Is am I understanding correctly?
Yes, absolutely. I mean, the whole goal here is to create a source of income for people to not have to work, to become independently wealthy. I recall as a teenage surfer driving to Malibu, quite often there was a little real estate office and had a big sign in front that said, one good real estate investment can be worth a lifetime of labor. And proper investment in real estate, it'll take care of you, the rest, as it has me. But coming back to your question, I prefer these smaller buildings because they're easier to get into. You can exchange up from, say you own two or three rental houses, you can exchange up, or you can save up enough cash to make a down payment on one of these. And the type tenants that I have and that I would prefer, I mean, mostly are in these smaller buildings, are like plumbers, electricians, heating and air conditioning, maybe some kind of a small distribution, wholesale distribution operation. That type tenant, they're stable in fluctuations in the economy. They're necessities. You know, I absolutely shy away from anything that would be an economy sensitive tenant. Like, say you, for instance, home entertainment operation where they have exotic screens and sound systems. That's fine in a rock and roll economy, but if times get tough, that's one of the types that's going to fold. So I stay with the basic type tenant. And one of the wonderful things about these buildings, these smaller buildings compared to residential rental properties, is that there's no phone calls in the middle of the night about a clogged toilet or a broken garbage disposal. The tenant is virtually responsible for maintenance of the building in every respect. And some of the leases, the landlord is required to take care of the roof, but almost all other things, anything you can imagine, is taken care of by the tenant. If there's a broken window, anything, it's taken care of by the tenant. And the leases are 3 to 5 years long, at least 3 to 5 years long. So you don't have people turning over every year or something like that.
You have a size of a building, and you have two types of structures that fit mm-hmm. the criteria, and then right. a small list of potential tenants. Mm-hmm. What about the age of the building?
Well, the newer the better, but if a building is properly maintained, these buildings will last for, 100 years. The metal buildings, they usually are guaranteed or life of at least 50 years, but they'll last for 100 years too. It's a matter of maintenance. And on these industrial buildings, there really isn't much maintenance. There's the roof, and the metal roof, I found metal roofs to be the best. There's various types of roofing material you can use. But the walls are pretty, bulletproof. There's nothing, well, nowadays, what isn't bulletproof or is bulletproof. But you change carpet, you paint the walls when the tenant turns over. If you have a plumbing issue or air conditioning issue, every 10 years maybe you have to change the air conditioning unit. The newer the better, but if it's properly maintained, age is not a problem.
What is the entry level investment? How much money do you need to have? I realize we're talking about a wide range of real estate markets here, but can right. you give us an idea of what do you need sure. in order to get started?
Sure. Well, it's going to vary depending on what area you're in, of course. But basically, if you're an investor, I say investor as compared to what would be a user. User is somebody who's going to occupy the building. Investor is someone who's going to buy it and lease it out and enjoy the income stream. If you're an investor, the bank is going to look for something around 35 to 40% down, at least 35% down. If you're a user, you can get in for less than that. Maybe you can get in, if you have a small business association loan, you can get it in as little as 10% down. But in this area, Southern California, or in California, I'll say Central California, this type of building, let's say a 5,000 square foot building, it would sell for around $700,000, $800,000 in that range. And so 35% down, 30% down would be around 240,000 or something like that. You need like 240,000 down. So, if you had a couple of rental houses that you could build equity of 100,000 each in, you could exchange those, a 1031 tax deferred exchange, you could exchange those into an industrial building and enjoy the lesser management problems that industrial provides.
Tell our listeners, if you would, about the 1031 exchange. Not everybody may be familiar with that.
Well, basically, it's an IRS, Internal Revenue Service provision that allows you to take a property that you have held for some period of time, over a year, and which you have developed equity in, and it's appreciated in value, and sell it and move the proceeds into another building without having to pay capital gains. And it's basically called a 1031 tax-deferred exchange, and an accommodator it's a service. Excuse me, that in effect they buy the building from you and they hold your money while you find another building. You have a period of time, 6 months or so, to complete the transaction. You find another building, and then in effect they buy the building and titles are switched, but it's just a way to avoid having to pay capital gains, which can be, substantial, 15 to 20%, or even more now. So I hope I explained that to your satisfaction.
And so the capital gains don't go away. They're just kind of on a shelf until you eventually exit if you decide to stop holding real
Yes.
estate. Is that right?
Yes. They stay in place, and they're moved into the new property, and your tax basis from the old one is moved into the new property. This is a little complex, but my recommendation to clients when I was representing clients is never sell. Don't sell your buildings. I mean, you want to keep that income stream. I mean, having your preserving your capital and having that income stream is all important, and minimize your loans. I always say, try not to, never have partners, try not to have any partners, and try not to have any debt. But you have to, most people have to start out with debt. You can't get around it. But you want to get those things paid off as quickly as possible, because you don't want the bank as a partner. I mean, they're not a good partner. The capital gains are rolled forward into the next property.
Speaking of banks, this is a topic that has been in the news, of course, in the last year in particular, and following the great financial crisis because of the bank-related issues, some of the banks that collapsed. There's also a lot of talk now about the commercial real estate wall that's coming in 2025. How is this that we're talking about, because we are talking about a type of commercial real estate, different from this other really large commercial real estate wall?
Let's make sure we're talking about the same thing. Are you referring to the realtor lawsuit that was brought against realtors on the subject of representation and commissions?
You mean the NAR?
Yes, and that is the only change that I know of. And if that is what you're talking about,
No.
it doesn't apply. It doesn't apply to commercial real estate.
No,
It
that's
applies to.
residential. That's residential real estate. There has
Okay.
been a lot of talk of late that there are a number of small to medium, so I think they call them small and regional banks across the country, that are overextended in terms of their commercial real estate loans,
Okay.
and that they are at risk of default. And so there is talk that the banks are already overextended and not wanting to lend any money. So this conversation that we're having falls under the commercial real estate hat,
Sure,
and
sure.
you're talking about a property that is likely going to require a first-time investor to borrow money from the bank. So
Yeah, I'm
would you
with you.
help us understand a little
Yes.
bit how those
Yeah.
two are different and distinct?
Right. And so what you're talking about is the problems that developed in the office market, in the office building sector of commercial real estate, because of the COVID and because of the all the lockdowns and all of the at home telecommuting move and all that. It created a lot of empty office space, and it created a lot of failing loans for investors in office space. And yeah, there would be a certain reluctance to make any office building loans by those large institutions. But for this type of, for industrial, it's a different animal than that. And it's a, it is, we have a minimal, very small, a very small vacancy factor in industrial, pretty much throughout the nation. And when I say for industrial, for smaller buildings, you get up into some of the warehousing units, 200,000-300,000 square foot distribution, that can fluctuate a little bit, but it's still pretty solid too. So, and community banks, you get into regional areas and you have community banks, they're usually pretty pretty aggressive and cooperative on making loans on small industrial buildings, particularly if you're a user, particularly if you have a company and you want to own the building that you're that you've been leasing, or you want to buy a building. Those banks are pretty cooperative on that subject.
What size of a market are we talking about when we discuss specifically the subcategory under commercial real estate of small industrial buildings? How many buildings is that?
Oh, let's see. Let me see. It looks like about 350,000 industrial buildings in the U.S. That sounds light to me.
Are those small?
No. That'd be all sizes. All sizes. But I have to imagine it's more than that. I did a market analysis when I was planning to write this book to see who would appeal to. And one of the submarkets was individuals would have a copy of this book for their family, heirs, and succession and management of their properties. And I Googled, and I think I came up with 350,000. But geez, that sounds awfully light to me. There's got to be more industrial buildings than that. There's 120,000 commercial real estate brokerage offices. I can tell you that. And about 10 million residential rental property investors.
How many investors of industrial real estate?
Let's see. Looking down. Well, it would be almost the number of equal to the number of buildings. However, some of those buildings are not investor-owned. They're owned by the company, which indirectly is a form of investment, too. But it would be in the hundreds of thousands.
Would something like a restaurant fall in this category?
No, that would fall under retail, where you have basically direct sales to the public. And let me take a moment and just run down through the market that I wrote the book to appeal to. I wrote it to appeal to people that are basically looking for a way to retire, because owning these small buildings, it yields an income stream that you live on the rest of your life. Second, to people who own rental houses and would like to trade them up, get away from the maintenance problems. Third, to people who have stocks in their 401k. You know, stocks are digital assets with multiple layers of intermediaries that affect the value that you don't have any control over, and you really don't have any control over the company who issued the stock either. And so you have far more control over an industrial building. You select your tenant, you draft the lease. It's a hands-on type investment. So, and it's more stable than the fluctuations of the stock market. The fourth category is businesses who are tired of throwing away money, paying rent. They want to own the building, build equity. They want to have control where they don't get kicked out at the end of the lease if the owner wants to sell it or lease it to somebody else that they prefer. The fifth would be professionals. Those who are looking for profession. Looking for a profession to retire, commercial real estate is a great profession. If you're not born wealthy. There's very few professions where you can become wealthy within your lifetime, and industrial is one of those professions. I mean, my dad didn't have a college degree. I'm the first in the family to go to college and graduate school. And I started in industrial late in life at 32 years old. And by 45, I had I'd become a multimillionaire. I have a beautiful home, a Mercedes, a Porsche, industrial buildings, all paid for clear and free, and hundreds of thousands cash in the bank, no debt. So all that, you know, was done within a relatively short time because of that, the field of commercial real estate. So the book is also written for people that are looking for a profession where they can truly make a quantum leap and get ahead. The sixth market is, I wrote it as a supplemental teaching study text for business schools and MBAs. It's broken out into 53 different subjects covering, you know, qualifying a building, buying the building, leasing the building, managing the building, selling the building. It's done in a way, it's very well done for teaching, a couple of subjects each session, and easy for study too, the way I've laid it out. And then the final section is, market is, a training aid for commercial real estate firms for their new employees. You have somebody read this book, and it's a relatively short read. You have somebody read this book, and they're up to speed very quickly on what they have to know to get out there and start making money. And so those are the markets that the book is aimed at. And it takes my 48 years of experience and condenses it down and lays it out in a understandable way that if you had to pay somebody, if you had to pay a professional real estate broker, an attorney, and an accountant to counsel you on what's in this book, you'd pay tens of thousands of dollars in consulting fees. The book's about $10, so it's a real, real bargain in that respect. Okay, what else would you like to ask me, Elena?
What are the best areas for our listeners who say, okay, I want to know more? Is there a likelihood that there are industrial buildings in my area? Are rural areas, are urban areas, are suburban areas? Where are these buildings likely to be?
Well, I'll answer that from two points of view. One, if you're looking at it as an investor, you're going to have these smaller buildings in almost all areas. I mean, they're absolutely going to be in cities, urban areas. You're going to have, usually around airports is one place you're going to have a lot of industrial development. But you're going to have a smattering of these smaller buildings in every city. But even if you go out into the urban area, or go out into the suburban areas and out into the country, you're still going to have some, because people still need heating and air conditioning, plumbing, electricians. They need those, and those uses, those companies need lodging. And so you're going to find these buildings in small little communities outside of Fresno, outside of Sanger, I mean, in Kentucky. I mean, you're going to find these little buildings everywhere. Now, the other perspective in answering that question is, if you're going to consider going into this as an profession, if you want to consider this a profession, you want to go in to not in a small area. You want to go where the biggest ticket items are, because that's where your commission is going to come from. You want to go into Silicon Valley. You want to go into Irvine. Irvine's where I had my company. And you want to go into parts of Los Angeles. You want to go into where large ticket items, large transactions are going to take place. So I hope that answered your question.
Are there counties or states where there is a greater availability of industrial real estate for purchase, because there might be a lot of industrial real estate, as you say, I'm hearing you say it's ubiquitous, but it may not be available. Why would someone sell the goose that lays the golden eggs?
That's a very good question. Yeah, they shouldn't sell the goose that lays the golden eggs. But you got two sources. One source is you have developers, real estate developers, that make their money by taking a section of land, subdividing it, and putting up small industrial buildings, and either selling the lot and then doing a build-to-suit building on top of the lot, or putting up the spec building and selling them. So that's one source, and it's mentioned in my book. The other source is you simply have people who, for one reason or the other, have to sell or want to sell. Someone dies. That's a reason. As much as I don't like the idea of ever selling a building, when my wife and I moved to our new home here in Paso Robles about a year ago, I don't like to have any kind of form of a payment of any kind, a home, a loan, home loan or anything like that. So I sold one of my buildings to use so I could buy this home, cash, over $1 million in cash to buy this home. So, and I hated doing it because I paid $200,000 in capital gain taxation on capital gains. I paid $200,000, and so I hated doing it. So my point is that they come up, and you just have to be on top of it. You've got to have a good broker, out there hunting for you, or you yourself, have to hunt them out to some degree. So they do come up, though.
How do you know if once you make the investment, you will be able to find tenants? Because it sounds really easy the way you're describing it, but real life and theory don't always match, right?
Well, one thing you need to do is you need to know what the vacancy rate is in the area where you're at. And you want to probably buy, you don't want to just buy a building out in the country somewhere with nothing around it. So you have no comparable situation. You usually want to, I always say go to an industrial park and buy a building in an industrial park. And then you have all the buildings around it. You can find out the vacancy factor by calling a broker and asking them what the vacancy factor is. They know that number. And if the vacancy factor is low, let's say under 8% or something like that, well, that there's a high probability you're going to get a tenant. If the vacancy factor is 50% or 20%, 25%, there's a higher risk in getting a tenant. So, you're going to look at the vacancy factor. Once you look at the vacancy factor, then it's just a matter of marketing. And the way I've written this book, I've written it so that if someone does not want to employ an attorney for contracts, and they don't want to employ a broker for representation, and they don't want to employ an accountant for due diligence, I've laid out all the steps for someone to be able to do those steps themselves. And the brokerage steps are they're doable. I mean, it's just a matter of the old basic one is, of course, putting up a sign on the property. But there's industrial multiple listing systems. You put the property in that, and you can register it with the local economic development corporation of the city that you're at. Put it into their inventory base, and then you can create a brochure and distribute that brochure to all the commercial real estate brokers in the area. There's steps you can take to market it yourself, and I always, because I was in the business, I know how to do it. I always do my own, and any individual, I think, following what I've laid out in the book can do that themselves as well.
How do you deal with the issue of tenants? It sounds intimidating. Putting someone into your building, what if they're not good tenants? What if they burn down the building? What can you tell us about that?
Well, it's the tenant is a critical factor, and that's where the proper due diligence comes in, the proper investigation, I'm extremely selective on tenants, and I would rather have an empty building than a bad tenant. I have a form. That form that I use, the application that's in the book, to get certain information from the tenant. I want to see their tax. I want to see their financial statements, income and balance sheet for the last 2 years. I want to see their tax returns, federal tax returns the last 2 years. I want to compare the numbers of the federal returns to what their in-house accounting numbers say. I go and physically look at their home, and I want to make sure that the principal of the company owns a home in the county where my building is. In case I ever have to sue him, I want to know that he has property there that I could attach if I had to, and that there's equity in it. And I make a list. I find out what other buildings he might own. I do a court search to see if any actions have been brought against them. I do a credit report, on them to see what their credit records are. I look at their car, see how neat it is. I look at their home, as I said, to see how the yard looks, everything. If it's messy, that's the way they're probably going to handle their business. I don't want it. It's a matter of doing a thorough, that sounds like an awful lot of work, but it's worth doing the work. And you're talking about probably putting in a day of work on what's going to end up being a 3 to a 5 year lease, but you're going to have peace of mind that you have some, and of course you meet with that person in person too. I mean, you don't just let the, if you have a broker represent, if there's a broker that brings them in, and you don't just work through their broker. You eventually want to meet with that person face to face before you sign any leases, and then you. Of course, I walk through their business and look at their business and see how it's ran as well.
How frequent is it necessary to evict a tenant in these situations?
Hopefully never, but I'm going to say, I'm trying to think, how many have I had to evict? I don't think I've ever had to evict. What I've had to do is I've had some abandoned. I had one abandon the building, and I had to legally retake possession of the building, but I didn't evict them. I had one that the lease was coming to an end, and even though they were a good tenant, I asked them to leave, and they were cooperative. And that's an interesting point, too, on being selective on tenants. One thing is I want to make sure that tenant, nothing to do with hazardous materials. I don't want anything that handles or produces hazardous materials in the building. And or that would be hard on the building or abusive to the asphalt or to the interior of the building. I'm very selective in the uses. But one of the use considerations is you don't want somebody who's going to be creating some kind of a byproduct or of their business that could cause you a problem, like this tenant that I had. They had copy. They handled copier machines for the state of California. They provided copier machines, big machines. I mean, the machines are like 4 foot high by 5 foot long, and they're big machines. They were in one of my 5,000 footers, and then they leased the building next door for their office operations because they were expanding, and they started using my building to put these machines that were going to be refurbished to trade ins and stuff like that. Eventually, the whole building was filled with copier machines. You couldn't walk. You couldn't walk from one inside of the building to the other. It's a big building. And I said to myself, hey, if they go out of business, I'm going to be stuck with these machines, and that's not going to be cheap to get rid of. And so I told them the lease came due. I said, I am not extending your lease. You got to clear these machines out. And they cleared them out. They're still in business. They're doing very well. They're nice people. But at least I could sleep at night. I had a new tenant. There's always another tenant. I had another tenant within a couple of months. So again, you got to be careful. I mean, like somebody is doing demolition. You don't want to have them in the yard area piling up debris of whatever they're demolishing. Being selective. I'm very selective with tenants. So that's what I'm telling you. That's how you make sure you avoid lawsuits, is by being very selective with your tenants.
You were saying that you wouldn't want any hazardous materials, but for example, one of the potential tenants you mentioned were plumbers and electricians. Don't they, by definition, work with hazardous materials? Certainly the electricians.
No, not really. Some of them, even if you have a pest, at one time I had a pest control operation, but you have to make sure if there's some small amount of petrochemical or something that they have that they store in an approved cabinet or something like that. That's one thing. That's not a problem. Some cleaning material or something. But no, those type companies, they don't work with any hazardous materials. I mean, a plumber, I can't imagine what they would have that would of any. I'm talking about people that would have 50-gallon drums of like automotive. I never take automotive. Automotive is going to have 50-gallon drums of spent transmission fluid, spent motor oil, things like that. Some people would have cutting fluids for machine operations. You have a milling machines or something, and they would have some kind of barrels of cutting fluid that would be pumped into these machines. Now, I don't want that type of stuff. So it's just a matter of being selective.
Which other small businesses would make good tenants?
Well, I've had contractors, I've had some, home builders that have done okay. I've had sheetrock people that have done okay. I've had aircraft parts company that has done okay. I had a shoe manufacturer that did okay. I've had, let's see, electricians. I've had electricians, multiple electricians. I've had I don't know how to answer that. I mean, it'd be an easier question for me to answer if you said a specific one, is it okay? Then I could say yes or no. But to tell you what it, there's too many to try to answer that question that would be okay.
You were talking about capital gains earlier and
Yes.
the issue of capital gains if you sell your building.
Right.
Are you able to make the purchase through a Roth IRA and then whatever gains you make are tax-free? Would that be a possible instrument?
No, there's no way that would. I mean, you cannot avoid capital gains on an asset. I mean, I haven't used a Roth deal. I mean, when I was brokering, I set up a corporation, a C corporation, and a profit sharing plan and a pension plan. I didn't use the 401k or the Roth or anything like that. But there's no way you can avoid capital gains on investment properties.
Why did you write the book? You've already found success. Isn't this a little bit like giving away the secret formula?
That's a very good question. I mean, I'm 80 years old now, and I'm pretty well 51 years of happy marriage. I'm good health. Plenty of money, so it's just a matter of entertainment. I'm pretty much have won the game, and so it's just a matter of staying entertained. And I have the knowledge, and I don't think that it's going to create such a horde of investor buyers that it's going to create competition for me and make it difficult for me to get tenants. It just seemed like something like a legacy type thing to do. I have the knowledge, and it didn't require creativity. It just is in my brain. It comes from my brain right to the page because I've lived it. I've done it for so long. So I really did it, I would say, more for entertainment than anything else.
Who is an ideal investor in industrial real estate, and who should stay away from this kind of investment?
Ideal investor, I would say, would be someone who, as I said, has small residential, has small rental houses, has rental houses, and tired of the hassle of them. But you get into larger, you get into some heavy-duty investors that own 10 or 20 apartment buildings, and the apartment buildings are threatened with rent controls and management problems. They're also very good candidates to get into larger buildings, 100,000 square foot, 200,000 square foot buildings. As far as who should avoid it, if someone read the book and they see the steps, for the average person, this sounds frightening. I mean, it sounds, and it is complex. It is complex, and it does take special skills. But if you read the book, you see that it's all manageable. I mean, that it's, you understand the steps, and then it's not as frightening. And so I would say almost anybody can handle it. I mean, the person that just bought this building I told you I reluctantly sold, she's a house, a widow, and she owns another building in the area too, and she her son owns some buildings too. Can help her. But anybody, I would say anybody is a good prospect for doing this. It's just a matter of, and you don't have to do all these steps yourself. You can hire a broker. You can hire an attorney to assist you. All it just cuts into your profits a little bit. That's all. I mean, if you hire a broker, it's going to cut into you maybe 6%. If you hire a property manager, that's 5%. If you hire an attorney, it'd cut into you pretty deep. But you can hire people to assist you with these things and still make out okay on the return.
What kind of a return should you expect? Is there a range?
Yeah, there's a range, and it depends upon the market. It depends on the property. It's called capitalization rate, and there's a formula for calculating the capitalization rate, where basically you take the rental income and you subtract away from it the expenses, taxes, insurance, maintenance expenses, and then you take that net income figure and you divide it by the investment that you put into the building, and the range will be anywhere from 3% up to 13%, and it's a risk reward type thing. The riskier the tenant, the riskier the area, the riskier the building, you're going to expect a higher return. And the more secure, you're going to expect a lower return. So the return is different in different geographical areas. I mean, you want to know what the capitalization rate is for your area so that you can judge whether the rent being received on the building you're going to buy is appropriate or not. Is it over market or under market? So you're going to want to know what the cap rate is. And this cap rate calculation is well defined in the book. I explain it. I use examples. And it's a little difficult to explain on the phone because it would be a matter of going through an example case using numbers. And unless you can look at them in front of you, it's hard to hold the figures in your mind to do that. But I would say on my buildings, the return right now is around 5%, but you also have appreciation. They go up in value. And it varies with time too. I mean, sometimes I've had returns as high as 10%. It depends on the economy too.
When you say, for example, 3%, or mm-hmm. until not that long ago, 5%, wouldn't it be easier to just put your money in the bank in a long-term or short-term CD or money market and not have to worry about all of the things that we've been discussing?
Well, up until just recently, you put your money in the bank, you're going to get less than 1%. Now, you can get, for a $100,000 CD on a 90-day deposit, you can get around 4%, which is nice. But you don't get any appreciation. I mean, it's still being eroded by inflation. I mean, if the inflation is 4%, 3% or 4%, you know, you're getting nothing on that money. Where if it's in an industrial building, the building goes up in value. It goes up in value usually faster than the inflation rate. I mean, I give an example. I bought one building about $500,000, and I held it for 20 years, and I sold it for over $1 million, well over $1 million. And so you get appreciation. And so that's the benefit compared to just putting it. And then if you put it into a money market or into stocks, you know, that can fluctuate. Or you can lose it all. I mean, the market can dump and you can lose the whole thing. You're not going to lose. If your building goes vacant, you're still not going to lose the building. I mean, you have to hold it and ride out a period of vacancy. During that, 2008, that big, what did we call it, the Great Recession, I did have one building sit empty for almost 2 years. But if you're going to hold these type properties, you're going to have these type properties, you do need a cushion in case. But that was a rarity. That's the only time I've had something like that happen.
What are the biggest risks? What are the greatest concerns that you need to take into account if you're going to make this kind of investment? Tell us a little bit more about that, if you would.
Well, the concerns, I would say, would be a vacancy. That's really the only rational concern you should have. And you really shouldn't have that as a concern, because these buildings, they usually lease up, worst case, 6 months. Best case, most of mine are seamless. I have a tenant wanting the building before the old tenant leaves. And the way that I handle the cleanup procedure, if I'm going to have a new tenant take possession of the building, I've leased it out, they're going to take possession, I want that building to be in primo condition when they take it. Everything is going to be pristine. Everything is going to be operational. Asphalt will be good. The walls freshly painted. The carpet, beautiful. All mechanical systems operational. I take pictures of all that, and I delineate it in a welcome letter, and I give it to the tenant. And as the lease comes to an end, if they're going to move on to a bigger property for some reason, I then walk through that building with a floor plan, and I make a list noted on with a number on the floor plan of every single item that is needs to be brought back to the original condition that they took that building. I draft that up, and I attach to it the welcome letter that they got originally that shows the condition, and I take photos of that, and I attach that, and I say, okay, here's what needs to be taken care of in the next 30 days before your lease is up. And I'm going to say 95% of the time, that building is taken care of, put right back. It's in such good condition that I usually have to do nothing to it for the next tenant to take over. And they're relatively seamless. The only other concerns, there's some other little pain in the tail concerns. American Disabilities Act, ADA, which is an absolute horrible piece of legislation. I mean, it's great for disabled people, I guess you might say, but it's a law. It's 2 inches thick, requiring building owners to do all kinds of complex modifications to buildings or enhancements to building to make them more accessible for handicapped people. The problem is, it is so complex that it's difficult to comply with. You can have a building built specifically to the code, and the next day, while it's a brand new building, have an inspector go through, and they will find something that's doesn't meet code. And the problem is that there's a lot of attorneys around that use this as an opportunity. Well, I shouldn't even go there. All I can say is that you've got to make sure that your building, if you buy one, make sure it's ADA compliant. And you can hire a inspector and make sure it's ADA compliant, and make sure that the tenant understands that they have to keep that building ADA compliant. If they do any interior improvements, they put some kind of aisles inside or a reception area, they put a reception desk, make sure that it meets the height requirement and things like that. And so that's a concern. And if you have insurance, you absolutely should have liability insurance. You're pretty well protected on anything that happens on the property. I can't think of any concerns beyond that.
There's been reports lately, and this is specific to residential property, so I don't know if it transfers to commercial property, but there have been reports of home buyers who have said their homes were turned in non-habitable condition, where they couldn't live in the home because it had so many problems. Is this something that you might have to deal with if you're buying a new building?
I'm not sure if I understand what you said on that. They're turned in? What did you mean they're turned in horrible condition? You mean returned by a previous tenant, or what do you mean by that?
These are home buyers who are buying from a developer.
Yes.
And when they move into their home, the home has problems that mean it's not habitable. The new owners, so it's a new property, and the owners have to move out because it's not in habitable condition.
You mean like a plumbing problem or something like that?
Like facades that collapse, mold behind the walls, all sorts of problems.
Yeah. Well, if you're going to buy an industrial park, the developer usually has a history, there's a lot of other buildings around that you can look at and see their product. But I believe that the statute of limitations on construction is like 10 years that the contractor has to stand behind the building that it's in proper condition. But, you're going to perform an inspection. I mean, I've bought new buildings and gone through them with a fine-tooth comb and gone through them multiple times little things have to be taken care of. And I write it up and draw it on a floor plan, put a number, write it up to us, email it to the developer. Here, this item, this item, this item. I mean, I've done that on homes that my wife and I bought back when, a tract home or something that's under construction. Go there on the weekend and look it over and see what you think is not being done properly and write it up. But no, I don't think there's a problem there. There's 10-year statute of limitations. I'm pretty sure that people are protected. That's just kind of a nothing to worry about. I would say that's not...
The experiences that you have had in your time in industrial real estate have been in California only, is that right?
That's correct, correct.
Do you think that the conditions in the other states are so similar that people can, in other states, can look at this information with confidence that it translates across borders?
Yes, yes, I do, because most of what's in this book is not law related. It's basics of marketing and management and planning and executing your plan and things like that. I mean, contract law throughout the United States is pretty standardized. You might have some peculiar laws that are peculiar to a particular area, like escrows, for instance, and I make note of this in the book. In some areas of the country, the certain escrow charges are paid by the buyer and certain by the seller. And it's just a custom depending upon what area you're in, and usually the escrow officer can advise you on that. But no, I think what's in here is pretty standardized. But what's even more standardized is I think you'd probably go back to Roman times. And what I've written in the book is going to be applicable. I mean, buildings, you know, real estate is the foundation of all wealth. And owning real estate and owning properties has always been, it's been around for long as civilization has been around. It's been around. This is pretty standard stuff. It's generally applicable.
What role does a title search play? There's been a lot of talk lately, for example, in residential real estate, that a lot of fees are going into title searches that are not justifiable. And there's been the addition of an AOL, I think it's attorney opinion letter, in lieu of title insurance. How does this translate to this commercial real estate industrial building space we're discussing?
Well, a title search is a necessity because you want to know that there's no liens against the property for one thing. You want to know that the seller has clear title to transfer it to you, and that there's no mechanics liens or any loan type of liens against the property. You want to make sure that there are no strange encumbrances like what's the word I'm thinking? I getting a metal block on it.
You mean like an easement?
Yes, easement. Do you want to make sure there's no easements against the on the property? If there are, you want to literally be able to see what the easement is and what effect it has on the property. Trying to think, what other elements there? Under certain circumstances, with commercial property, you might even want a survey done on the property to make sure that the dimensions and the sizes are appropriate too. But title insurance it's a necessity, and there's almost no way around it. If you're going to get a loan, the lender's going to demand it, and there's two types of title insurance. There's standard and then the type that the lender requires, and ALTA. And so I don't know any way around it. It's a necessity.
Obi, thank you for joining us from Paso Robles, California.
Well, thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
And to our audience, you have been listening to Obi Silverwood, author of Industrial Real Estate Investing and Management, who discussed investing in industrial real estate. To propose a guest for the show, you can email me directly at editor@HispanicMPR.com. That's editor@HispanicMPR.com.